San Francisco's tech boom, skyrocketing rents, unprecedented evictions, and the Google buses are receiving national media attention. Tension over widening social and economic disparities continues to grow, but what's being done about it? Community meetings and protests have raised awareness about what's happening, but the rents continue to rise and longtime residents are still being forced out. On today's Your Call, we'll talk about the changes we're seeing and possible solutions. How can we start a healthy dialogue? And how is this boom affecting your community? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said that intensive and urgent discussions are underway after the main Syrian opposition body, the National Coalition, suspended its participation in this week's peace talks on Syria in Switzerland. The Syrian coalition was reacting to Mr. Ban's invitation to Iran to attend the preliminary meeting of the peace talks, known as Geneva II. A spokesman for the Syrian National Coalition, Anas Abdar, said Iran should not be part of the talks as it had troops in Syria supporting President Assad and had not endorsed the establishment of a transitional government.
Unless we get these two points clearly and unambiguously clarified by the Iranian side, we would like to ask the Secretary General to withdraw the invitation that was forwarded to Iran. Otherwise, we in the National Coalition will not be in a position to attend Geneva II conference.
The United States and the European Union have announced they're suspending some trade restrictions on Iran. Earlier, the United Nations Nuclear Agency, the IAEA, confirmed that Tehran had started curbing uranium enrichment as part of an interim deal. The agency said that Tehran had stopped enriching uranium above 5%, well below what would be needed to produce nuclear weapons. The EU's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, welcomed today's developments.
I'm pleased to say that Iran has implemented the nuclear-related measures set out in the agreement, and we have adopted the necessary legislation to suspend certain sanctions for a period of 6 months. The suspension of these sanctions will enter into force today.
Parliament in the Central African Republic has chosen Katrine Samba-Panza as interim president. Ms. Samba-Panza, who was the mayor of the capital Bangui, will have the task of trying to restore peace to a country ravaged by religious conflict. Richard Hamilton reports.
Mrs. Samba-Panza was elected in a second-round runoff, defeating the son of a former president. Many now hope that the new interim leader, who's seen as politically impartial, will help to bring calm to the nation that has seen thousands of deaths since rebels deposed François Bozizé in March last year. The former mayor of the capital Bangui is a Christian and a businesswoman. Christian militia, which had earlier threatened protests against the vote, said they were happy with the election.
The South Sudanese army says it's recaptured the key town of Malakal from rebels. An army spokesman, Philip Aguerre, said its soldiers had flushed rebels out of the town, which is the capital of Upper Nile State, one of the country's main oil-producing regions. But a rebel spokesman denied the report, saying the town was still in rebel hands. The spokesman said the army attacked the town, but had been repulsed, suffering heavy casualties. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. The Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, has issued a statement saying that continuing clashes between police and anti-government protesters in the capital Kiev are a threat to his entire country. He's urged dialogue after a leading opposition figure, Vitaly Klitschko, called on all Ukrainians to join demonstrations in Kiev and to fight, as he put it, for the future of their country. The worst violence yet is taking place in temperatures well below freezing around Ukraine's parliament. Our correspondent in Kiev, Daniel Sanford, reports.
For well over 24 hours now, this street leading up to Ukraine's parliament has been the scene of non-stop fighting between demonstrators and police. The protesters are bombarding the lines of riot officers with cobblestones and petrol bombs while supporters bang on lampposts and oil drums. The police are firing some kind of plastic bullets, gas canisters and stun grenades, and even throwing back the cobblestones.
One of the world's leading conductors, the Italian Claudio Abbado, has died. He was 80. Claudio Abbado was the principal conductor of some of the world's best-known orchestras, including La Scala in Milan, the Vienna State Opera, the London Symphony Orchestra, and the Berlin Philharmonic. The European Space Agency says it's waiting to see whether the Rosetta spacecraft has come out of hibernation, a decade after being launched to chase down a comet. Rosetta's space operations manager told the BBC that contact would only be made with the craft at the end of the hibernation exit procedure in a few hours' time. Only then will scientists know whether it's functioning properly. The European probe has travelled 800 million kilometres through space and for the past 2.5 years was asleep, awaiting a rendezvous with a comet that may carry the chemical building blocks for life, frozen since the birth of the solar system. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. San Francisco has always been a desirable place to live, but this latest tech boom and the influx of new residents paying skyrocketing rents has created tension between the new dot-com community and longtime residents. San Francisco's rents and soaring home prices, unprecedented evictions, the closure of longtime businesses, artist evictions, and the Google buses are receiving national headlines in the media. San Francisco now has the highest median rent in the country, surpassing New York. The Mission District, which has historically been home to the working class and immigrants, is now being referred to as Ground Zero for San Francisco's eviction crisis. And at the same time, since 2009, technology companies have created 23,500 jobs in the city. With an unemployment rate of 5.3%, San Francisco has the lowest unemployment rate in the country. So on today's Your Call, we're spending the hour talking about how we should address the growing divide created by the tech boom. How can we start a dialogue about the changes we're seeing, and how should we create livable cities for all? How is this affecting your community? Today, we're joined by Gabriel Metcalf, Executive Director of SPUR, a nonprofit that promotes good planning and good environment and government through research, education, and advocacy. And Gabriel joins me here in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Hi.
Great to have you. And Tim Redmond is the founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online newspaper focusing on investigative reporting and analysis. Tim is former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, and Tim is also in studio. Hi, Tim. Welcome back.
Well, thanks. Always happy to be on your show.
Great to have you. So it's kind of wild to live in San Francisco and then watch the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times write about the Google bus protests or evictions, high rents. Tim, you're a longtime resident of the city. What's really changing, or what really strikes you about this tech boom this time around?
Well, the intensity of it, the amount of money there is, and the permanence of it. I mean, the first dot-com boom, we were talking before we went on the air, there were a lot of companies that were just air. There was a lot of money coming in that you knew. You just looked around, you knew that in 2 years these companies wouldn't be here. This time around, I mean, there's actually established businesses that are making a lot of money that are going to be here a while, that are paying very high salaries. And the extent of the displacement is beyond anything I've seen before. I'm talking both residential and commercial displacement. I mean, rents have gotten so high that landlords now have an incentive, and property owners and speculators have an incentive to do whatever they can to get rid of longtime tenants so that they can flip the properties and make a lot of money. And it's going on an unprecedented basis. To the thing that really strikes me, even more than the last boom, is the kind of fear that we see. And, you know, we have politics in the city now driven by fear and anger. And because, you know, every tenant, every person who rents an apartment in San Francisco wakes up in the middle of the night thinking, oh, my God, I could get an Ellis Act eviction in the mail in the morning and I'd be gone, not from my apartment, but from the city. And I think when you get that kind of fear, it creates a real challenge for people who are interested in political solutions.
Ellis Act evictions are up 170% since 2010.
And that's just the ones that actually go to eviction. When you actually look at the numbers, you think, okay, there's, you know, 300, 400 evictions here. There's this many a month. That's the tip of the iceberg, because what's happening all over, unregulated, undetected, you know, there's no record of it, is landlords going to tenants and saying, look, tomorrow morning, I'm filing the Ellis Act eviction. I'll give you $25,000 to leave peacefully.
Right.
And the buyouts, are happening on a larger scale, and there's no record. We have no idea how many of those are happening. It's just anecdotal.
Yeah. It's interesting because this happened to some friends, and a number of Google executives were eyeing the building for a while and then found the landlord and offered him a couple $1 million. He took it, and that's exactly what happened. Yep. Gabriel, what stands out for you in terms of this tech boom?
Yeah, well, I actually agree with everything Tim just said. The size of this boom relative to the size of our housing stock is bigger than the dot-com boom. And so we're seeing a crisis of affordability that's actually worse than happened before. Tech jobs are still only 8% of private sector jobs in the city, but because of the multiplier effect, you're seeing employment growth in every sector, from manufacturing and hospitality and healthcare. Every sector is growing, so you have this enormous demand for housing being driven by the job growth, and so fear and anger are exactly the spirit of the time right now.
And you know, the interesting thing is that tech is only 8% of the employment in San Francisco. Obviously, the biggest employers in San Francisco are still public sector employers. But I think, and again, I have no evidence in this, I think that the number of tech jobs that are attracting workers from out of town, as opposed to attracting existing unemployed San Franciscans, I think that, you know, if you look at hospitality, you're more likely to get hospitality jobs going to people who are already Bay Area residents. You're more likely to get tech jobs going to young people who are moving here for the first time to take those tech jobs. So I think that's why people are looking at the tech workers more than workers in other industries and saying, you're the one who's driving me out of my house. Because in fact, that's what, you know, there's more people just moving to town to take these jobs.
Right. And a lot of people who actually work in Silicon Valley are being bussed back and forth.
Right. Because, you know, it's at the tenant convention this weekend in The Hate, somebody said, and I've heard this before, it's like, what we really need to do is make Silicon Valley more attractive so people will live there. And everyone laughs, right? No one wants to live in Sunnyvale. If you're 25 years old and you're single and you love nightlife, you don't want to live in Sunnyvale. You want to live here. So it's not just tech jobs in San Francisco. It's tech jobs in the region.
And why don't you talk a little bit about the tension that you're seeing? Because I attended a community meeting a couple months ago in the Mission, and there was just a lot of anger. And at the end of the meeting, we said, all right, so what are the solutions? And people said, well, there's this protest, go to City Hall. But people were frustrated because they couldn't really come up with tangible solutions. So first off, why don't you both talk about some of the tension that you're seeing? Tim, what are you seeing?
Well, I'm saying, you know, I mean, this is what drives, for example, the Google bus protests. I mean, you think back rationally, all right, who would be against companies using buses to get their workers to work instead of having them driving cars on the road? All right, who would be against mass transportation that saves on greenhouse gases? That's all the things that we all believe in, right? You know, in theory, you'd look at it, it's like people should be mad that Google's got all these people with cars driving. No. They're putting their people in buses, and that's a good thing, right? Who would go out and protest people trying to get to work? We're protesting the workers. But the Google bus is a big, shiny, private example of what people are mad about. And, you know, I think people are having a tough time. Well, I feel like they're angry. They want to do something. What is it that we can do? And this is why I think, you know, we're starting to see some focus. There's been two regional tenant conventions. There's going to be a citywide one February 8th. I think we're starting to look at what are we going to do about housing? Because that's really the root of this. People aren't angry at the tech. Well, some people are angry at the tech workers because they're going to their favorite bars and now you can't get a seat. All right. But mainly people are angry because they're worried about having a place to live.
Well, yeah, I think Tim's right. The issue here is housing. Look, this tech boom has bad and good in it, in its effects on the city. And the bad is what we've been talking about, which is this extremely expensive housing stock that's happening, which is driving displacement and much beyond the number of people actually displaced is just the fear that if something happened and you had to move, you wouldn't be able to stay in the city. So that's the bad. There's also good, and the good is that we are we're in a regional economy that has figured out how to be successful in the modern world when vast stretches of America have never recovered from the entrance of the developing world into global competition with them and can't figure out how to make anything the rest of the world wants to buy. We have this model of how to have an economy that can generate jobs. The unemployment growth is much lower. There's also, by the way, huge growth of money going to city government. The year-over-year increase in taxes to our city government, our little tiny city, it's a $700 million increase in 1 year. And we do really good things with that money. We have an extremely progressive city, and so there's good and bad. So the solutions, I think, are in two areas. They're in transportation policy and they're in housing policy. Mm-hmm. And we have really had a terrible failure in both of those areas. And so the constructive place to channel the anger and the fear is not protesting the symbols like the Google bus, as Tim says. It's to change our housing policy and change our transportation policy.
Okay, so let's focus on housing because this one is really important. And I mean, even if you don't live in San Francisco, people are leaving San Francisco to go to other cities. And now I'm hearing from friends who live in Oakland that that's changing Oakland and Berkeley and you name it. And you now, it's very common to see a one-bedroom go for about $2,500, $2,800 a month. So you wrote a piece for The Atlantic, Gabriel, called The San Francisco Exodus. And you write that San Francisco has produced an average of 1,500 new housing units per year. Compare this with Seattle, which has produced 3,000 units per year over the same time period. And it seems like there are a couple things going on. You've got skyrocketing rents, and then we're seeing these new, a very upscale condos being built, and there are a lot of them being built for incredibly high rents. So can you talk about why there's such a disparity there?
Yeah, so I think the main thing to understand about housing policy is it is a mistake to think you can solve it with one sector. There are people whose job is to focus on rent control, like the people at the tenants union. There's people whose job is to focus on public housing. I think my sort of premise would be we have to focus on housing at all levels, from public housing to affordable housing to market rate housing. And the only way we're going to solve the problem is a very multifaceted housing strategy. There's a sort of straw man out there of people think you can build your way out of the housing crisis, and nobody thinks you can build your way out of the housing crisis. What I think is that if you're not building a ton of housing, you make all the other problems harder to solve. It's an important part of the solution, but it is not the whole solution, and that's just silly.
And how do you do that in San Francisco? Because we don't have much space, so you build up?
Yeah, you build up. You build, first of all, on parking lots. Second of all, one-story commercial buildings. You would tear them down, and then you would build taller. And a great example of that is Upper Market Street right now, where you have hundreds and hundreds of units under construction, taking advantage of existing transit on what were either gas stations or parking lots.
Tim.
Well, it's funny. The mayor in his State of the City speech seemed to think he could build a way out of the housing crisis because he said supply and demand, the laws of supply and demand still work even in San Francisco. That's actually not true. The laws of supply and demand in housing don't work in San Francisco because the demand is so infinite. There's so many people who want to live here.
I want to debate that later.
Okay. But beyond that, what we have done here in San Francisco is we have, in part through public policy, in part through the vagaries of the market, and I don't think you can say it's 100% of one or 100% of the other. Policies at City Hall did not create the tech boom. Right. The Twitter tax break helped bring more tech companies into San Francisco. If Twitter had lived in had moved to Burlingame, then many of the Twitter employees would still want to live in San Francisco. So whatever mix of market and economic development policies, we have brought many, many thousands, probably 25,000 new employees from out of town to San Francisco without either having housing available for them or making sure that we have first protected the existing vulnerable residents. We did not have laws in place that made it so that if you lived in San Francisco 5 years ago, 20 years ago, if you've been here a long, long time, your housing is secure. What we've done is we've brought in all of this economic growth without first securing existing housing. Right now, in a housing crisis, the most valuable housing is existing affordable rental housing, because it is way cheaper to protect existing rental housing than to build new affordable rental housing. Building new affordable rental housing is a priority. Taking housing off the private market, which is really, in many ways, hard to control. I mean, the San Francisco housing market is being driven not by San Francisco. It's international money. I mean, money now is a completely international fungible commodity. It goes where the return is. If you can get... If you can buy a building in San Francisco for $500,000, flip it and sell it for $1.5 million profit in 3 months, money's going to come and do that. All right. So taking that housing out of the private sector and putting it into the public sector, all of these things need to be done. That's expensive. That takes a lot of money. All right. Making sure that current renters are not evicted and that rent control apartments are not taken off the market, that's a cheap policy answer. That's, you can pass laws doing that. That doesn't cost any money. All right. So that, I think, is one of the things that we have to focus on right now, is how do we get rid of this fear and anger by working to make sure that long-term San Francisco residents are not displaced by newcomers.
Are either of you talking...
I actually totally agree with that.
Okay.
That we released our 8-point housing plan, and point number one is protect the existing rent control stock. And it is where you start.
That is Gabriel Metcalf, Executive Director of SPUR. Tim Redman is founder of 48 Hills, a progressive online paper focusing on investigative reporting. He's former editor of the SF Bay Guardian. And we actually did reach out to a couple different tech companies, Airbnb and Sidecar. We also contacted San Francisco Citizens Initiative for Technology and Innovation, but they weren't able to offer anyone to come on the show. And so today we are talking about the tech boom in the Bay Area and Northern California, and the rents we're seeing, the soaring home prices, evictions, the closure of many longtime businesses. Right now, Modern Times at 24th and Mission is trying to stay open. If they can't raise enough money, they said they might have to close their doors. And so we're talking about what a healthy dialogue would sound like. And if you work in the tech industry, we'd love to hear from you. If you've been affected by the tech boom, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What changes are you seeing in your communities? And what will it take to create livable cities for everyone? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex.
Good morning. I just don't understand the logic of holding landlords responsible for housing issues. Suppose I have an X number of dollars and I want to invest in a restaurant, a gas station, or a mechanic's shop, or build an apartment. Why should I be singled out for rent control? And nobody talks about controlling the price of items in a menu at a restaurant.
One good reason is that right now San Francisco is in a housing crisis, and housing is a fundamental of life. Like food and water, housing is a fundamental of life. And so we in a city like this simply have to regulate housing. And we've known that for many years. The debate over whether we should regulate rents, you know, that has ended many, many years. We have very few people now would actually come out and say we shouldn't have any type of regulation over housing in San Francisco. It's one of those things that there are times when the private market doesn't do what it's necessary to do, and we simply have to step in and regulate it.
You know, another view on this, I would say there are many downsides to rent control, but there are also many upsides. But in a place like San Francisco, where the supply of housing is severely capped, it does not make sense to cap supply but not cap price. It would be totally unfair, and it would be totally unfair to people having to purchase rental housing. Prices would go up, and there is not an ability to bring the supply up, which is, by the way, I think the root of the problem. I really think that is the reason why we have made our housing crisis so bad. But in the short run, rent control is the only thing allowing huge numbers of people to stay in the city.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Alex. Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill.
I just wanted to make a comment about the Google buses or the tech buses. And I guess my comment is that I think it's more than just a symbol, because it seems like they have allowed vast numbers of workers who work in Silicon Valley to turn San Francisco into a bedroom community. And I think that's really pushing up a lot of the rental prices. And it's also creating a two-tiered public or private public transit system where they're competing with the public transit system instead of using existing resources. I'd just like to hear a comment about that. Thanks.
No, it's your points are very well taken. And in my comments that the Google bus was a symbol, I'm not saying that there aren't also significant policy issues involving the Google buses. I mean, they're now paying $1 a stop to stop at the Muni stops, which is incredibly low.
And we should say it's not just Google, right?
Yeah.
Genentech buses.
No,
they're not labeled, so it's hard to know.
I know.
Which
they're
one.
Called the Google buses. There are many, many different companies that do this.
Right.
And, you know, I understand it's, you know, these are private, not public transportation, that are clogging up what is the public transportation system. You do get this feeling that this is privatizing. And also, we have seen, there's no question, there is evidence. There's a study from UC Berkeley. I don't remember the woman's name who did it. But there is evidence that, in fact, because this transportation is available, it is driving up rents near the stops where this transportation is available. So all of those are issues that we need to think about. You know, the flip side of that is, let's ask the question, if we didn't have the Google buses, would young workers be more likely to live near Google? I don't know. And if they lived in San Francisco, would they be more likely to drive in private cars? Maybe. So I think these things all ought to be put in the mix. Yeah.
Yeah, guys, look, the root of the problem here, again, is a failure of policy. We have essentially not invested in the region's public transit system since BART. BART opened in 1974. That was really amazing, by the way, during the height of the post-war boom when the entire country was devoted to the automobile. The Bay Area went a different direction, made this extraordinary investment in BART. And since then, we have rested on our laurels. We have not added to the system really at all. We have a completely inadequate regional transit system. I would submit to you, I mean, look, the vast majority of people who work in tech out of the city but live in the city, the vast majority are still driving. That's who you should direct your anger to. Those companies that have figured out how to get some of their employees out of the car, it is better. It is not the best, but it is better.
Well, and one of the arguments is that rather than having these companies fight for better public transportation for everyone, they're just providing private buses to their employees. What do you think about that argument?
I don't see evidence of that. I work really hard on Caltrain and high-speed rail, which is going to use Caltrain. And the reason why we're getting anywhere with upgrading Caltrain is because of the support of the major employers. It's one of the reasons why the governor has come out so strong in favor of high-speed rail and helped fund Caltrain. So they actually want Caltrain upgraded. I also think over time, if we manage to make Caltrain better, you will see a land use change, and you're already seeing it as companies begin to move their employment centers to be near transit. But there's a lot of inertia in the built environment, and Silicon Valley was built in a very suburban way, and it's going to take decades to work ourselves out of that and gradually have the employment centers relocate to transit.
On tomorrow's show, we're going to talk about these community benefit agreements. And in exchange for setting up shop in San Francisco, a lot of these companies are getting city payroll tax cuts. And so we're going to talk about that relationship. But because we couldn't get a tech person on the show today, we called Sidecar and Airbnb. Gabriel, are you in contact with these tech companies? Are you working with them on these issues?
I know some of them. I mean, so Spur is a membership organization. We have about 5,000 members and about 300 or 400 business members. We actually don't have very many tech companies in Spur yet, but we have a few. So I do know some of them. And yeah,
is there a dialogue about these issues happening?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So look, from the perspective of the innovation economy, the Bay Area is a very magical, special place right now. We have this bringing together of all these different kinds of people, this openness to creative people from all over the world. And it is good for the world if we can find a way to solve these problems. And the tech companies very much would like to make it work, right? They would.
Well, hold on, Tim. We're going to take a quick break. And today on Your Call, we are talking about the tech boom and really what a healthy dialogue sounds like. The tension is building, but where do we go from here and what are some solutions? How has this affected your area and what changes would you like to see? It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue this conversation and we'll talk about the pact between the city of San Francisco and high-tech companies. Actually, it's not just San Francisco. This is happening in various cities. So what happens is companies get millions of dollars in payroll tax breaks in exchange for setting up shop, and then they're supposed to give back to the community. So what does that mean exactly? And if this exists in your city, how is this playing out? And then on Wednesday, we will talk about Governor Jerry Brown's state of the state. He has officially declared a drought in California. We did a show about this last week. And so we will talk about the various issues that he brings up on the state of the state. So be sure to tune in for that. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the tech boom in Northern California. We're seeing very high rents, soaring home prices in San Francisco, unprecedented evictions, the closure of longtime businesses, artist evictions. The Google buses are receiving national headlines. So what are your thoughts on this? What are some solutions? What would a healthy dialogue sound like? We contacted Airbnb and Sidecar and the San Francisco Citizens Initiative for Technology and Innovation, but we couldn't get someone from the tech sector on the show. So if you work in tech, we'd love to hear from you. And if you live in a community that has changed as a result of the tech boom, what changes are you seeing and what kinds of solutions would you like to see? It looks like we have full lines, but we'll have one open in a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Gabriel Metcalf, Executive Director of SPUR, a nonprofit that promotes good planning and good government through research, education, and advocacy. Tim Redmond is the founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online paper focusing on investigative reporting and analysis. He's former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. And just briefly, Tim, before we get to phone calls, what role does the tech sector play in this? Obviously, they can play a huge role when it comes to solutions. Are you talking to them?
Well, I think that the tech sector should play a role in solutions because, in fact, I don't think that, I mean, first of all, the tech workers are making a lot more money than a lot of us, but they also, many of them are renters, and they're trying to find housing in San Francisco, too. The reality is there have to be policy changes to protect the housing stock in San Francisco, to protect the affordable rental stock in San Francisco, and to make more affordable housing and more housing that's available to everybody. These require government action. And what I'm not seeing from the tech companies, I'm seeing, you know, Ron Conway, who's a very wealthy investor and VC person, getting involved in discussions with the mayor's office around taxes and around some of these issues. But what I'm not seeing is the tech companies working with the tenants and tenant organizations to say, okay, let's see how we can solve some of the housing problems. One of the things that absolutely has to happen to preserve San Francisco as an affordable place is we have to get rid of the Ellis Act, which allows a landlord to evict all of his or her tenants and sell the building. Now, this is not, in many cases now, this is not a 80-year-old person who's owned an apartment building for 40 years and wants to sell it and retire. This is a dozen or so out-of-town speculator companies that come into San Francisco, buy up any building they can, kick out all the tenants, flip it, and make a profit. That's what's going on. Now, I don't really think that Google has a dog in that fight. I don't really think that Google is on the side of the speculators. Why would they be, right? I don't think that Airbnb or any of these tech companies, I don't see any reason. There's no capitalist business reason why they would not be willing to take their money, their clout, their resources, and work with tenants and go up to Sacramento and say, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to repeal the Ellis Act, at least as it applies to a city like San Francisco. And if not, hey, we've got the money to put something on the statewide ballot. We could raise $30, $40 million in an eye blink to put something on the ballot. Why aren't they funding the tenants union and the groups that are fighting for affordable housing in San Francisco? Why, you know, Twitter got this huge tax break. Why aren't they taking some of that money and putting it into affordable housing in San Francisco? I mean, I could see why the tech companies aren't going to agree with me on taxes. I can see why Twitter had a significant economic interest in getting a tax break to move to San Francisco. All right. I disagree with that. Gabriel and I can disagree about that, but there's an economic interest there. Twitter has no economic interest in soaring housing prices. In fact, it just hurts their employees. Why can't they work with us with the resources they have to be part of the solution?
Yeah, I guess my view on this would be, so do the tech companies have a responsibility to be part of the solution? Well, yes, they do. They do not have a greater responsibility than any other business, however. They have the same responsibility. The businesses that locate in San Francisco are part of the community, and all the ways that businesses can be part of the civic dialogue, the tech companies need to be. And I think that's, by the way, that's going to be a change, especially the early stage companies where they're not making money yet. They're in startup mode. They are not thinking about the broader civic conversation. And so I think there does need to be a cultural change. That said, these tech companies, just like companies in any other sector, finance or hospitality or manufacturing, they are not going to be the experts in housing policy or in transportation policy. They are going to need to support the civic consensus that we come up with through the rest of the public dialogue that takes place on shows like this and in papers and at City Hall.
The companies that got a tax break, a payroll tax break from the city to set up shop here, do they have a greater responsibility? I mean, Twitter gets a tax break, they go public, and they create 1,600 millionaires in one day.
You know, I think there's a lot of misinformation about this. There was a geographically targeted tax break to try to get companies into mid-market. Maybe you could say, in hindsight, given just how huge this boom has turned out to be, maybe they would have gone anyway. But at the time, we had been in the middle of 40 years of failed attempts to get anybody to go into mid-market, and it was filled with vacancies. The Furniture Mart, where some of these tech companies now are, was almost entirely empty. It seemed, and it still seems to me, like a good bet to try to do a geographically targeted tax break to get companies into mid-market. And by the way, the vast majority of tech companies in the city are not there. Right. The vast majority of the tech companies are paying their normal taxes.
Right. But it was a geographical tax break, but it was the primary driver of this was trying to get Twitter into the Furniture Mart building. That's what got the mayor to push this. If Twitter had not been considering moving into mid-market, and by the way, if Twitter had not been concerned about paying taxes on those stock options that made those 1,600 millionaires, that's what drove it. The payroll tax wasn't it. It was the question of when they went public and made all of this money, would they have to pay city payroll taxes on those stock options? If it hadn't been for that, the pressure for the geographic tax break, I think, would have been a little bit lower.
But it would have been so easy for them to just be south of the county line, by the way, like every company that ever did an IPO was, because you have this absurd situation where these little companies, in the year of their IPO, would have been paying vastly more taxes than PG&E or Wells Fargo or Bank of America or The Gap or all these much bigger companies. It actually makes sense the way we finally solved it, which is switching to a gross receipts tax. And we probably should have just done that in the first place.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's take a few, and then we will get responses from our guests. Tim Redman, founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online paper focusing on investigative reporting, and Gabriel Metcalf, executive director of Spur. Let's hear from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby.
Hi, good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, thank you. This is such an informative show, and I have a really harebrained idea that I'd love, you know, opinions on, if it would at all be possible. We're talking about changing behavior, and it's really difficult to change somebody else's behavior. It's not impossible. But taxes and laws work. I like the new idea about the bus stops. Would it ever be conceivable to tax a tenant if they are not working in San Francisco? They all, the landlords have to know where they're working because they all have to fill out copious resumes of employment history, etc. So in other words, the person who is not living in San Francisco, why would they be not working rather in San Francisco? Why would they be living in San Francisco? We think we know the answer, but ought they not to pay a tax for that privilege?
Well, whether or not that is a good policy idea, and we could debate that, it actually, we can't, because the state preempts that kind of taxation. You could actually do the opposite. You can tax employment in San Francisco, but you can't tax people who live here and work somewhere else. It's the state doesn't let you do that.
I don't like that idea. I think one of the great things about living in the Bay Area is that we have a regional labor market. You can be in a couple, and each of you can work in a different city. If you lose your job, you have access to this big range of jobs across the entire region. I actually think it's a good thing that we have a regionally interconnected labor market.
That said, we certainly could tax the Google buses more than $1 per bus stop, which is about half of what you have to pay to get on a Muni bus. And it's insane that we had this negotiation with them and came up with such an incredibly low rate for use of public space. I mean, the fact is, the tech buses are using public space. My tax dollars and your tax dollars paid for those bus stops, and we're now renting them out to private companies for a fraction, a tiny fraction of their value.
All right. Thanks again for calling, Ruby. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Good morning. Everybody wants to live in the area of central San Francisco, south of Market and on Market Street. And one of your guests said that the idea is to build up. I would like to suggest that we also should consider building out. And I don't know what's happening in the area south of Mission Bay in the Dog Patch area, where we now have that 3rd Street Rail going with great transportation. And I also would like to ask your guest to address the issue of housing for families, which, you know, I know Tim is a family man, and I think we need to attract more families to San Francisco.
Well, that's a big question. There is an awful lot of development going on in the southeastern part of the city, certainly around the Hunters Point Shipyard area. There's a tremendous amount of new construction going on. My question, of course, is we have the 3rd Street Light Rail. I don't think that's even close to adequate for the amount of housing that the city is talking about and that regional planners are talking about putting in southeast San Francisco. We're going to need to spend a huge amount of money, billions of dollars, on added transit to handle the influx of people that could happen if we continue to build that way. And, you know, it's the family issue is tough. I mean, really, what it's about is the cost of housing. I mean, you know, the people say that families are leaving San Francisco because of the schools and all that. Well, you know, I got two kids and I send them to public schools, and I'm actually quite pleased with the San Francisco Unified School District. My kids are getting a good education in the public schools, and I have no problem with the schools in San Francisco. The challenge that people have is finding a place that you can afford for your family. And it comes down to that same question. When people have kids, you can't live in a one-bedroom apartment for very long when you have a kid. So then you need a bigger space, and since bigger space is so incredibly expensive now, that it's the cost of housing that's driving families out of the city.
All right. Thank you for calling in, John. Let's go next to a longtime artist in San Francisco. The last time we saw the dot-com boom, so many artists were driven out, and we're seeing the same thing happen again. Now I would like to welcome Chrissy Kiefer to the show. Chrissy is co-founder of Dance Brigade, an amazing all-female dance company, and they're out with a new piece called An Ablution of Hope and Spare. It runs from January 24th to February 8th. At Dance Mission in the Mission District. Hi, Chrissy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you so much. So you're a longtime resident of the Mission District, which is now being referred to as Ground Zero for this eviction crisis. Chrissy, what are the main differences you're seeing between the dot-com boom of the 90s and the one we're seeing right now?
Well, it seems like what's happening now is there's significantly more money invested in the area and significantly more international money invested in the area and a significantly more amount of people moving into San Francisco that actually don't work here, that actually work, you know, down in Silicon Valley. So we sort of have this, you know, kind of feeling of being a bedroom community for Silicon Valley. And if you live in the Mission, like I've lived for the last 20 years, you know, you walk out at 8 o'clock in the morning and literally there's hundreds of Google buses driving their people down to, you know, the Southern Peninsula. And the feeling here is edgy. People are pissed off. There's lots of people being displaced, lots of people who've been part of the community for years who've kind of built the world view that I actually feel very protective of. I think there's something unique about San Francisco culturally that's kind of not anywhere else in the world that's being completely dismantled and pulled apart. And I feel like we didn't get on top of it soon enough to the point where we've seen lots of long-term activists and artists and internationalists and thinkers being kicked out, displaced, and moved away. And this new kind of overwrought, petty bourgeois, glamorized culture is moving in to replace that. And it's disturbing, it's heartbreaking, and it's making a lot of people really angry. And so people are there's, you know, there's antagonism in the street in a way that I did not feel at all when the last dot-com boom happened. There was kind of a pissed off at City Hall, but now the contradictions, quote, among the people are very amped up, and it's problematic.
You know, and that's one of the reasons why we wanted to do this show, because there is such a tension that you can really feel this time around. Do you think a dialogue is taking place, Chrissy? And what kind of conversation, dialogue would you like to hear?
Well, I think here's the deal. You've got these billionaires running our city right now, you know, through Facebook, Twitter, Google. They just did a pet project out on, you know, Treasure Island, where they spent $350 million building a ship out of containers. Now, that $350 could have been infused into the nonprofit sector of San Francisco to kind of mitigate the problems that are happening right now. Did they choose to do that with their money? No. They choose to go out and have this, like, dog and pony show out on Treasure Island where they wasted millions of dollars. And so I think the kind of idea that we're going to get together with them and solve the problem when they're actually the ones that are actually part of the whole kind of NSA spying thing that's happening at the same time. I mean, this is huge. This is not, you know, the old kind of ideas that we have about solving problems and kind of getting people to work together. Unless there's heavy, heavy pressure put on them, that's not the way they're going to go, is to solve the problems that the artists and activists and immigrants are getting kicked out of San Francisco. As far as they're concerned, good. You know, so I think we need to have a whole nother way to think about it. And actually, I'm not kind of on the bandwagon right now to solve that kind of problem.
Gabriel, you wanted to jump in?
Well, the caller said a lot of things, but one thing I want to pick up on is this idea about the culture of San Francisco being destroyed potentially by the housing crisis. And I think that's right. And to me, the thing that is so maddening about it is that the traditional San Francisco politics around growth, which is we think the city looks really good. We don't want to see our neighborhoods physically disrupted. What we have de facto done over many decades, this is not a new thing. It's since the mid 70s. We have prioritized the architectural preservation of the city at the expense of the cultural preservation. We have made it incredibly difficult to add housing, so it takes years and years and years. We have created the situation in which we have said people's views are more important than the ability of other people to live in the city. And we still, from my perspective, we have not even begun to fight in terms of what we have available to us to do at the local level to change course on our housing policy. But if we keep going the way we have been going, yeah, we're going to see the culture of progressivism in San Francisco be destroyed.
Tim, do you think it'll reach that point? Is it that bad?
It's that bad. And Chrissy, I'm really glad that you called in. Good morning. Thanks for calling. I agree. This is a crisis. This is not a mild policy discussion. This is a crisis. Gabriel and I disagree about the prioritizing the solutions. I actually think that what we need to do is be more restrictive about our existing housing stock, and we need strict controls on who can be thrown out and how much rents can be charged in San Francisco. But I think that we agree that this is a alarming, frightening crisis, and that something has to be done right away. Now, the other thing is, we could decide today that we're going to allow 15-story buildings, 20-story buildings all along Valencia Street, all along Mission Street. We're going to build 50,000 housing units in San Francisco. We're going to build 10,000 housing units, whatever it is. There's a lag time. It's going to take years to build that housing. People are being evicted today. So before we, in my mind, before we even think about that, the first thing we have to do is stabilize our existing housing stock. And we have to all act as if this is the crisis on the level of recovering from a, 8.7 earthquake, that this is something where we just basically have to say it must be done before we even think about anything else.
Well, I want to thank Chrissy Kiefer for calling in. She is the co-founder of the amazing dance company Dance Brigade. It's all women. They use taiko drums. It's really an amazing company. And they've got a new piece called Hemorrhage, an ablution of hope and despair. And it runs from January 24th to February 8th at Dance Mission Theater in the Mission District. And you can find more information about this at yourcallradio.org. They're focusing on this piece on global warming, the attack on women, using the backdrop of the Mission District and the onslaught of eviction. So be sure to check that out. And we've got time for a few more callers. Let's hear from Tara in Burlingame. Hi, Tara. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for hosting the show. I'm calling. I live in Burlingame. I'm a public school teacher. We're facing the same rental challenges, and several people in my apartment building, for example, have had their rents raised, and the fear of the unknown, the uncertainty of what am I going to do when that happens, I think is a large thing that many people are dealing with. And my primary bone of contention is I think our society has always honored the police and the firefighters with salaries and raises, and they really cultivate this concept of having such people work in their community. And the public school teachers can barely afford to live in this area. And of course, I have my own personal stress about this, but I've always wondered how a society is not in an uproar, because if we have a poorly educated society, it will cost all of us a great amount of financial detriment in the future. And there are teaching housing apartments available in some towns, but it's very restricted. You can only live there for a certain amount of time. So it's not really a long-term solution. So I was wondering if your guests have given any thought to this problem facing most of the teachers, including those in San Francisco.
You want to go first? Go ahead.
Gabriel.
Well, look, teachers got to get paid way, way more. I think that's just clear. You know, in terms of housing policy, teachers are in the same boat as artists and a bunch of other people, and we've got to fix our housing policy to take care of all of those groups of people that need to be able to be here.
I think the idea of saying that teachers should be paid as much as police and firefighters is, an excellent place to start, at least to start. Obviously, the odd thing is, of course, we pay police and firefighters in San Francisco significant amounts of money, and most of them don't live in the city anyway. Whereas I think a lot of teachers would like to live in San Francisco and be part of this community, and it's one of the many crises we face. And as I say, the thing that worries me is there are teachers, and I don't know where you live now, but there are teachers who live in San Francisco who may be forced to move to Antioch if they get an Ellis Act eviction. And think about how fair that is. Think about this for a second. Is it fair that somebody who's lived in San Francisco for 20 or 30 years, who's making a middle-class salary, is forced to move 40 miles out of town and commute and pay that extra money to commute? that comes right out of their pocket because somebody who's richer is able to force them to be evicted. I really don't think that's fair.
Tara's in Burlingame. Let's go. We have time for one more caller who wants to talk about organizing. Let's hear from Beth in San Francisco. Hi, Beth.
Hi, thanks for hosting the show. I know that there's been a lot of meetings at City Hall between the mayor's office and the tech community, and there's been a lot of great town hall style meetings about housing that have been traveling through all the neighborhoods in San Francisco. From my perspective, it seems that there's a big disconnect between those two groups, and I know that Gabriel Metcalf, you've recently been appointed to oversee an affordable housing committee, so I'm wondering if there is going to be some kind of discussion between that group that you're working with and the community groups that are hosting these town halls and what that would look like.
Yeah, okay. So that's a great question to lead to the just topic of solutions. So SPUR just came out with its 8-point plan for housing affordability. And you know, Tim and I actually seem to really agree on what point number one is, which is protect the existing rent control stock. I would submit that the beauty of that is it has no conflict whatsoever with adding to the housing supply at all levels. As long as you're not tearing down existing rent-controlled units, as long as you're only building on parking lots or one-story commercial building sites or gas stations or parking garages, as long as those are the only uses you're displacing, no human beings, then the beauty of this is that you can try multiple solutions and we don't have to know in advance who's right. But I would submit that there are about 30 things we can do at the local level that are legal that would lead to the creation of vastly more housing at all income levels. The mayor's office is looking at this, as is the planning department, as are the board of supervisors. I think you're going to see a flurry of activity in 2014. And I'm actually cautiously optimistic that we will make some progress.
Hmm. At 30 seconds, Tim.
Two solutions that have been talked, many solutions have been talked about at the tenant conventions that are worth looking at. One of them is an anti-speculation tax that essentially would be a very stiff transfer tax on property that is owned and sold within 1 year. That basically, if you buy a piece of property and flip it within a year, you'd have to pay a very, very stiff tax that would make that unprofitable. The other is substantially increasing the relocation fee for an Ellis Act eviction to basically make it so that if you Ellis Act somebody, the person has to pay the difference between their current rent and market rent for a long period of time to keep them in San Francisco.
Well, we have full lines. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we knew this was going to get a lot of attention, so we will continue this conversation tomorrow. Tim Redmond is the founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online paper focusing on investigative reporting, funded by his readers. And Gabriel Metcalf is executive director of SPUR. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you. Right,
thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How do community benefit agreements work? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about a pact between the city of San Francisco and high-tech companies, which receive millions of dollars in payroll tax breaks in exchange for setting up shop in the city. San Francisco requires tech companies to give back to the community to receive these tax breaks. But who really benefits? And does this exist in your city? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.